Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Paul Craig Roberts. Paul, I want to talk about your newest article and whatever else you may have in mind. I'll mention one thing. In mid-December in 2007, almost to the day, I believe, so almost 7 years ago to the day, I wrote an article that I still go back and refer to every now and then because it was rather extensive, rather detailed, and I called it Police State America, A Look Back and Ahead. And what I did was I simply reviewed all of the key laws, police state laws, repressive laws that were enacted post 9/11, plus presidential executive orders, Bush executive orders, presidential memoranda, some memos, other things called national security and presidential security, I believe. National security, I forget the name of the darn thing. It's been so long since I looked at my article. But other publications, government publications out of Washington, that basically give the president the right to decide what the law will be, irrespective of what Congress does. National security presidential directives, I think, was one. And the other, right. Homeland security directives. Four words, I left one out, Homeland Security Directives and National Security Directives. But it really is an administration initiative on its own, regardless of what the law says, regardless of what Congress does. So, you know, it's government by diktat. And the whole article in summation basically came to the conclusion that America is indeed a police state, and that's certainly the point that you make.
Well, that's right. I think it's been obvious since the beginning of the George W. Bush regime. Those initial presidential, or rather national security directives and executive orders required a national catastrophe. There had to be grounds for the president to declare a national catastrophe, which was a change from the former wording of all these directives that go way back in time. They used to be national emergency. But under Bush, it became a national catastrophe, and if the president declared it, it was up to him how much power he would share with the courts or Congress. He might go through the process, or at least the appearance of sharing decision-making for the sake of comity. But it was up to the president to decide. Well, that put the basis for the president to behave as a Caesar should there be some outside event that he could seize on and sell to the public and to Congress as a basis for exercising that power. What's happened since is that we had all the succession of memos written by the Justice Department, essentially under Bush, ruling that because we were at war. Again, this was a critical part of the argument that we were at war, and at war the president has special kinds of powers he doesn't have in peacetime, and those powers let him disobey existing statutes on the books. This is how he got away with the first revelation that the NSA was spying without warrants. You may remember a whistleblower leaked that to the New York Times, and they sat on it for 1 year and awaited Bush's reelection before the New York Times let the information out. We had the John Yoo and the Busby memos that the president could torture, and that he didn't need to pay attention to the U.S. statute against it or the Geneva Convention. because he had unitary powers in wartime that placed him above the law. So those kinds of things developed. Now, there was some opposition to that and some rollback, but it was like the old Lenin statement, two steps forward, one step back, and they kept gaining one step each time. And they managed to get these powers accepted as presidents, even though they weren't in statutes. And at one point, the Obama administration, which of course continued this practice, the Obama administration actually opposed and was able to defeat codifying the powers that the executive had accumulated. Because if these powers were codified, that meant then that they were limited by law, and that the executive branch went any further, it would be in violation of law and held accountable. And the argument from the Obama people was, don't open that can of worms. We are happy with the fact that we have these presidents and can do this, and we don't want them. We don't want these powers codified because that implies a limit and implies accountability on the use of the powers. So we do have, over the two terms of Bush and the two terms of Obama, this sort of movement into a unique role for the American president, in which if there is war, he is essentially a decision maker independent of existing law, both domestic and international. So we have seen many tests of the public's acceptance of these new powers. We've seen the highway stops by Homeland Security and searching of cars on highways. We've seen, in other words, the expansion of the airport security to the nation's streets. We saw the Boston Marathon bombing incident, whether this was real or set up. Instantly, there were 10,000 troops on the streets with tanks, and the entire city was locked down in its suburbs. And these heavily armed troops were invading people's homes, ordering them out so the homes could be searched. Well, everyone knew that this wounded 19-year-old kid wasn't in those houses. But this was a test for acceptance, if fear would cause the public to go along with this, either fear of the bomber or fear of the armed troops that showed up. So we do have, and then, of course, the latest NSA spying that Snowden revealed. Actually, I don't think he revealed anything that Binney hadn't already revealed, but Snowden had the documents. And Binney, who was simply a very high-level NSA official who had designed the whole program, the thousands of NSA people reported to him. When he blew the whistle, they just said, oh, he's disgruntled. But he didn't take any documents in order to prove what he was saying. And so they got rid of his evidence. And that's, I think, why Snowden took the documents, because he said, well, if they won't believe one of the top officials in the NSA who reveals what's happened, in fact, the guy who designed the spy program, they're not going to believe me either. I'm far lower placed, and so I'm going to have the documents. And so I think it's harder for the government to say somebody disgruntled when the documents are there, they back him up.
John Snowden, of course, got the attention of the whole world, and that made a major, major difference to make world headlines in important newspapers, even though most of them would not tell the full story. The London Guardian certainly covered a lot of it.
That's because he had the documents, see.
Oh, yeah, the documents, absolutely.
It was the documents that got the attention. And Benny, they tried to prosecute Benny. I mean, he didn't flee, but they didn't have a case because he hadn't taken any documents. And so, whereas they can claim Snowden was a spy because he stole the documents and released them. In other words, whistleblowers, their word doesn't count against the government unless they've got the proof. So, What the Benny and Snowden episodes do is to prove that.
Of course, Obama, John, has prosecuted more whistleblowers than all previous presidents combined. It really is astonishing when you think about it. The number is something like maybe 7 or 8 of them. Bradley Manning and Snowden hasn't been prosecuted yet, but they really want to get their hands on him. But Bradley Manning, of course, has been literally put in prison for 30-odd years. So, and the others, names that people wouldn't know, not household names, but they were prosecuted, and some of them had the book thrown at them, and some of them much less so, and who knows what's coming. And, of course, they've gone after journalists, too.
The interesting thing is, though, that whistleblowers are protected by U.S. law.
Well, they sure are.
So, what's become of this law? How come the law that protects the whistleblowers?
The Whistleblowers Protection Act, John. Paul, I'm sorry.
No, really, there is a law that protects whistleblowers. And so it's what has not been explored, or not that I've seen explored, is what's become of this law when they get prosecuted. I mean, if they're legally protected by law, how can they be prosecuted for blowing a whistle? And I suppose the way the government does it is it doesn't define them as whistleblowers. It denies that they're whistleblowers and says that they are Chinese agents or spies. Or you may remember that the initial attack on Snowden from I forget who it was, whether it was a security official or a congressman or a senator, was that he was a Chinese spy.
Because he was in Hong Kong.
Yeah. So it may be that the way they get around the law protecting the whistleblowers is that they simply say whistleblowers are not whistleblowers. And so they're not protected by the law because they're not whistleblowers. They're spies or they're something else. in other words, we've lost the protection of law. Because what takes precedence is that the government can hide its crimes and its agenda so that it can pretend to be doing one thing publicly and actually doing something else. And anybody who reveals that has no protection because the government takes precedence over law. And that, I think, is what the definition of a police state is, that there's essentially no protection of law for the people, or even for government members. And so whoever has the power in the government, then, they become the law because there's no protection of law. And I think that's what's happened in the United States. My colleague Larry Stratton and I, in a book first published, I think, in 1990, about how the law had been lost. The publisher called it The Tyranny of Good Intentions. Why, I don't know. Publishers' titles don't always have anything to do with the content. But what we showed was that this was prior to 9/11, the war on terror, all of that. We showed that the legal protections in law had already been eroded away, that prosecutors and police and liberal and conservative groups chasing after their devils didn't want the law in the way. And so the law had been sort of cut down across the board so that convictions could be more easily obtained. And as a consequence, frame-ups became routine because it was easier to frame a person, even a guilty one, than to convict them on the evidence. So our book just goes through everything and shows how the legal protections of the people in the Constitution had already been destroyed. So this was prior to the War on Terror.
Oh, indeed. There's something called continuity of government, Paul. You're probably familiar with it. And it's really an old idea. And on the one hand, it's probably a good idea to have something in place so that if some kind of catastrophe befalls Washington and people running government are killed, and if there wasn't something in place to continue government in their absence, we'd have chaos in the country. So in that respect, it's a good idea to have a secondary system in place. But the Bush administration...
Now, we've always had those systems.
I think so. I think it got solidified a few decades ago. Maybe it goes back further than that. It might even go back to the post-World War II era. But again, it's a good idea, but the Bush administration just took it to the extremes, created a shadow government that was effectively a coup d'etat government, and Dick Cheney was the one who had the supreme power, not George Bush. So if a martial law would be declared, the Constitution suspended, whatever, for whatever reason the people in Washington wanted in the Bush administration, literally this is the kind of system that would be activated, and they had some secret place where they could go, I guess where they planned these things, and where they could set up shop if there really was something awful going on in Washington, some underground secret place where they could be protected. And I forget exactly where that might have been.
Well, I was, I was a presidential appointee, and I was part of it.
There was you were part of it.
About Mountain, where I was supposed to. First of all, let me just let you and your audience know, I believe this backup system, as you call it, originated because of the possibility of nuclear war.
Yes. Yes.
With the Soviets. And when I was in the Treasury in the early 1980s, my office was deemed sufficiently important that I was one of the people that would be taking over government should I survive and others not. And there was a place outside of Washington in Virginia that was a hollowed-out mountain. And it was all equipped with all kinds of things and billions and billions of printed dollars. And I was supposed to, in the event of a nuclear attack or warning of one, leave Washington, go there, and be prepared to take over if higher figures didn't survive. And we actually would have to play war games in which an attack would take place, and who survived and who didn't survive, and so on. And so, but the great difference was, Stephen, that the president's declaration of such an event, even after it was expanded beyond nuclear war, it could be canceled by Congress. So he could declare it, but Congress could revoke it within 90 days. But beginning with George Bush, there was no power left to Congress to revoke a presidential declaration of a national emergency or catastrophic emergency, so that from the George W. Bush regime on, if a president declares one of these, then he has to also undeclare it. Nobody else can. The courts can't, and Congress can't. So this was the major new development, that there was no longer any check from the other branches of government on a president who might declare such an emergency so that he could have power and continue in power like that. So that was what the Bush regime contributed toward the police state, that today the president can simply say, there's a national catastrophe and I'm taking over. And that means he's not subject to elections. And he can stay in office forever unless he declares the emergency to be over. So that was the big difference between the previous presidential directives to deal with national emergencies and those of the Bush-Obama era.
And the 9/11 event was the pretext for claiming the right to do this, and the war on terror and everything that's happened thereafter, including the literal hot wars and everything else. So it really accelerated to something. I never imagined things would get as bad as they have, Paul, in the last dozen years or so. And instead of getting better in any respect, they seem just continually to get worse.
Well, yes, that's true. And also you can see we prepare Americans for it by encouraging allies to go further. For example, I believe it's correct that in Japan recently they have now restricted the press. They didn't want the press covering the Fukushima disaster very closely. And so they've passed some kind of legislation in Japan which simply curtails the ability of the press to report and criminalizes it if they do. So this sort of precedent in Japan, a democracy, our ally, creates the grounds for a similar thing to happen in the United States. And so as you said a few minutes ago, these restraints on whistleblowers can be extended to the media and to you and I and others who are foolish enough to tell people what's really going on. And the Japanese development is a precedent. And I think they're trying to push similar legislation on the Germans so that they have more cover for doing it here. But, of course, you see here, there's not much danger from the press because the standard TV and radio and print media don't ever reveal anything anyhow. It's just the Internet and just a few of those. Many of the Internet sites won't touch many issues. So here, there's not quite the danger to the government of having its nefarious deeds revealed by media because the Internet is huge and voices on it are easily lost. And what comes up on a Google search is up to Google, and they cooperate with the government, as we've learned. So I think that's one reason that they haven't already extended these restrictions to the media.
Oh, indeed so, Paul. You know, we write articles, and we're lucky if we get a couple of thousand people to read them. And if they get reposted multiple times, maybe it can be several thousand, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people who would read them. But it's a vast difference from the millions of people who get their news from television, not so much from newspapers. They read the newspapers, but they read, you know, the sports section, the business section. They read the headlines. They really don't dive into the content very much of what's written. And if they do, they'll read the first couple of three paragraphs. So if there's anything important, the writer can bury it well into the article, which the New York Times is infamous for doing. Oh, so it's hugely important stuff they've covered that I've written about. And literally, to get the kernels of truth that were important, you had to get down to paragraph 20 or 25, in a very detailed article, and few people do that. So you can be truthful that far down, and the word doesn't get out to the majority of people. So if you watch television, you are certain to be kept in a state of ignorance. You literally don't know what's going on.
That's right. In fact, I'm sitting here now looking at a release today from MarketWatch about the third quarter U.S. GDP growth rate.
4%.
It says U.S. third quarter growth raised to 4.1%. Consumer spending, business investment, faster than originally estimated. The U.S. economy expanded in the third quarter at its fastest pace in 2 years, owing to stronger consumer spending and business investment than previously reported, according to newly revised government figures. Well, that's as far as most people read. But then when you start reading, you see, well, what is this consumer spending? Well, it was health care and gasoline. So it deprives people of any discretionary income to spend on other goods and services. So,
some economy.
In other words, gas prices are high and health care is costly, and so that was the increase in consumer spending. And
the stuff that everybody has to buy, Paul, is the stuff that goes up. But that's right, people have no money left, and the only way they can do a lot of what they're doing is to max out on their credit cards, and there's a limit to that. I don't know how much longer that game can go.
They can't put it on the credit cards. They're maxed out. There hasn't been any growth in consumer income in a long time. In fact, right now, it's substantially lower than it was in 2007. And also, there's no credit expansion because they haven't the income to go deeper in debt. So there's nothing to drive aggregate demand. So there really can't be a recovery. And you see, then the second part of this MarketWatch report, you have to read the whole thing. It turns out, why is business investment up? Well, it's because of all the accumulated inventories in warehouses. You know, inventories are counted as GDP growth, whether or not they're sold. So now maybe they'll sell all these things at Christmas time, but with what the people are going to buy it with, I don't know. They haven't got any growth in income, and there's no expansion of real consumer credit. So what the story is really saying is that consumers can't buy anything because they spent all their money that they had as discretion on gasoline and health care. And business investment went up because of all the unsold things in the inventories in the warehouses. Now, that's the story, but that's not the headline of the story.
The real story is pretty dismal, Paul, and you've written so many articles explaining it. They're really on Main Street. We have depression conditions with terrible poverty and unemployment and underemployment and homelessness and hunger and the rest of it. And you never hear very much about this. You practically hear nothing about it, just that the stock market keeps going up and up, and you get these government numbers that change all the time. And John Williams, who you quote every now and then, sets the record straight and deconstructs the numbers and tells the truth about them. We're just about out of time.
Yeah, we're out of time. Well,
yeah,
it goes fast when we talk.
A final quick thought, Paul.
Well, Stephen, I'd like to congratulate you on all your coverage of the Ukraine.
Oh, you're very kind. You're very kind.
It seems that Putin won again.
Well, he did for now. He really seemed to have outfoxed the EU, and I think Washington has been the power behind the EU, manipulating the EU to do this kind of stuff. But it's a dirty game that keeps going on, Paul. You know it's not going to end. A tug of war to literally get all the former Soviet republics into the Western camp and to weaken Russia, isolate it, keep it surrounded by military bases and offensive, so-called defensive missiles, on and on and on and on. Just a dirty game that continues. It really is scary and despicable. So it keeps me busy writing about it. Paul, I very much look forward to getting you back next month. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, a good New Year next year. Gee, maybe we'll get a New Year, Paul, that really turns out to be a better one than the previous one. Wouldn't that be a wonderful exception?
It would be, but I don't see the basis for it.
I don't see it either. I've got to sign off. Join us again over the weekend at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.